Generative AI just kind of was a step change in the possibilities that it could bring to the world in solving problems, complex problems, and offering a multitude of optionality in creating solutions. This is an iterative technology, right? It's one that's continually changing and learning. And regulation, as a lawyer, I can tell you, is kind of static, right? So here we have a mechanism in the law or in regulation that's somewhat static, trying to regulate a technology that is going to be ever changing. It's not equal, right? It does not reflect all of society across the world equally. It's slanted toward the wealthy. That's who's used technology. It's slanted toward the Western world. It's slanted toward, I hate to say it, white, right? Men.
Welcome to the Regulating AI podcast. Join host Sanjay Puri as he explores the dynamic and developing world of artificial intelligence governance. Each episode features deep dives with global leaders at the forefront of regulating AI responsibly, tackling the challenges using AI can bring about head-on and enabling balance without hindering innovation.
Welcome to Regulating AI, the podcast that brings global voices together to discuss fair and responsible AI regulation. I'm your host, Sanjay Puri, and today we are thrilled to have Joanne Stonier with us. Joanne is an Executive Vice President and a Fellow of Data and AI at Mastercard. She's a global data expert and strategist with extensive experience in data governance, privacy, and ethical AI practices. Her background spans financial services, technology, and academia, making her uniquely qualified to discuss the complex landscape of AI regulation. Welcome to the show, Joanne.
Thank you, Sanjay. It's a pleasure to be here.
Excellent. Joanne, we have a global audience, policymakers, think tanks, technology leaders around the world. Can you share for them your journey as to how you became a fellow of data and AI at Mastercard? And what does that role actually mean?
I get that question a lot, so thank you for letting me answer that. So I've had a long career in both data and privacy, and as well as in more recently artificial intelligence. And so I've had a journey at Mastercard first as their first chief privacy officer, and then as their first chief data officer. And a couple last year, after we spent a full year on generative AI, with a lot of conversations with our board, our senior leaders, there was a recognition for both me as the chief data officer and Ron Green, who is our chief information security officer, that both of us had played a role in those positions. Being engaged external to the organization to understand both the risks of our respective areas, as well as the opportunities and innovations in the space. And given that generative AI is a real pivot point technologically, both for risk and innovation, there was a decision made that a new kind of expert would be created for the firm, and we were designated to be Mastercard Fellows. And the idea behind the fellowship is that it frees us up from kind of day in and day out operational responsibilities to kind of really have us focus on our external roles, as well as free us up to take on responsibilities with external organizations, including the World Economic Forum, the USCIB, which is the International Chamber of Commerce, and other organizations of companies and consortiums where we can lead thought leadership projects on, for me, data policy, artificial intelligence, both on the innovation, regulation, and risk space, so that we can really push and lead on practices related to innovation and regulation, policy, and risk. So that's what I've been doing. Again, I was the first privacy officer, the first data officer, and now I'm one of the first fellows. And so we're defining it a little bit as we go. But what I'm finding is that I'm at the leading edge of many of the conversations that we're all having about this new technology and what it means for all of us. And I guess the main thrust for us is that we handle this new technology responsibly for our customers, our cardholders, as well as our employees and our banks, our merchants around the globe.
Oh, that's fantastic. So external facing, working with strategic partners is what the role entails. And,
then, of course, bringing all that information back to MasterCard so that we can continue to design and lead in our practices as we continue to change and grow as a firm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, Joanne, you obviously, you know, have had multiple roles, and now you are engaged with some key strategic organizations. So when you look across, in your view, what are the most pressing challenges in terms of regulating AI, while also making sure innovation flourishes so that, you know, we get the benefits that the transformative nature of AI can provide, whether it's in healthcare and education and other things?
Yeah, no, I think that, you know, this is, I think everybody's recognized that while data analytics and artificial intelligence have continued to really change our world from a digital perspective, generative AI just kind of was a step change in the possibilities that it could bring to the world in solving problems, complex problems, and offering a multitude of optionality in creating solutions. But it also has some risks in the amount of data, the amount of resources that it consumes, and the amount of change that it's engendering in society. And as a result, also the amount of data that it consumes and how it uses that data and how it then creates conclusions and then uses those conclusions to keep generating information and keep learning. And so I think that from a regulatory perspective, we're seeing global regulators and governments wanting to make sure that this time we protect our citizens, right, our people, from any kind of unintended consequences or unintended harm. Now, of course, that's a little challenging when this is an iterative technology, right? It's mm-hmm. one that's continually changing and learning. Mm-hmm. And regulation, as a lawyer, I can tell you, is kind of static, right? So here we have a mechanism in the law or in regulation that's somewhat static, trying to regulate a technology that is going mm-hmm. to be ever changing. So I think right there, we have a tension. So I think lawmakers are trying to get ahead of a technology that's going to be changing, while industry is also experimenting and trying to figure out how it fits into their business models. And we also have a citizenry that is also trying to learn. So it's mm-hmm. kind of a perfect storm for, we're not going to get any of this right. But I mm-hmm. do think that everybody for the first time is trying to figure it out together, which is, first of all, a very important step in the right direction.
Right.
What I think most organizations, including regulators, governments, commercial enterprises, academic institutions are trying to do is create frameworks of thought that will be adaptable as we continue to see the change that's going to be engendered by this technology of generative AI. And so making us all accountable in the development process, in the outcomes, in examining the quality of the data that's being consumed, recognizing that all the data that's been generated up until this point by civilization mm-hmm. was not created for this use. It's not equal, right? It does not reflect all of society across the world equally. It's mm-hmm. slanted toward the wealthy. That's who's used technology. It's slanted toward the Western world. It's slanted toward, I hate to say it, white, right, men in general. But increasingly, we recognize those flat sides and we can adjust for that. So we can make things better. But at the same time, we recognize that we have other issues that we still haven't solved on. Everybody doesn't have electricity. Everybody doesn't have running water. So I think we, in recognizing some of this, we can also deploy the technology in a more responsible way. I think that's what regulators want. I think that's what most organizations want. But how do we do that in a way that really helps and makes sense in a thoughtful way, even as everything is changing all at the same time?
Wow. There's a lot to unpack and a lot to follow on those different threads. So let me, at least I have three different questions there. But let me start with one. You said, you know, we need to come up with a framework. The technology, Joanne, as you said, is moving very, very fast, which it is. You know, we started with large language models. We have now multimodal. Now we're talking about agents, et cetera, and regulations and lawmakers. And we've had many of them on our show. And their challenge is, how do we keep pace? What are your suggestions? Because, you know, lawmaking takes a long time. And I'm here in Washington, D.C. or in Brussels, etc. How can it be an evolutionary law, or as one of the members of Congress said, that we are only going to be doing it incrementally? So any suggestions? And that's my first question from what you talked about.
Sure. So I think we are getting better at thinking through how to navigate this landscape as lawmakers, right? So I'll put on my legal hat first and say that, you know, we have things like the NIST standards that are being, you know, that we have the first draft of those. I think that even the EU AI Act tried to do it from the standpoint of harms that could be created rather than trying to regulate technology today that's going to change tomorrow. And I think that those are the right approaches. I also think that there's a lot of discussion around, do we create a centralized AI regulation, or do we allow for AI in context? For example, let it be regulated by financial regulators as it's applied so that we understand the harms that AI can cause in financial services, in healthcare, in communications, right, in manufacturing, in retail, so that we can actually understand it in the context in which this tool is being applied. I suspect we're going to wind up in a place where there will be some general standards of understanding harms that can be, that need to be defined across sectors. And then within each sector, we also will understand how this tool can amplify harms, both intentionally and unintentionally. And we will need methodologies to protect citizens and of countries and individuals to make sure that we actually handle that. I suspect that's going to be the methodology that we're going to get to. That's where I think we'll get to. I think for regulators and legislators right now, I do agree it's going to be incremental. They're struggling right now with what's the baseline law, what's the baseline requirement. And for the first time, they also have to try to do this across an ecosystem of kind of the large language model creators, right? We talk about the model creators and consumers. We have a whole new, right, developers and deployers. We have a whole new language being created of what are the respective responsibilities, right, of someone who's just creating a model versus someone who's deploying a model for a specific purpose and context, and what are the related responsibilities? I think all of these discussions are super important, so that everybody understands the responsibilities, but also works together to prevent the harms that are being identified. And I do think eventually we will align on the harms, that the harms definitions will begin to be more unified, both nationally in the United States, but then also globally, because I think that's going to be the place where we're going to agree on what is harmful to an individual or to a group in society.
So you're saying basically the way the EU AI Act has, you know, identified the levels of harm, et cetera. But you also were saying about industry specific. What would your recommendation be? Should we have industry specific regulation for AI, or a comprehensive AI regulation? Or some folks say regulate the outcome, not the technology. Lawmakers are listening to you right now, so Joanne, what would your recommendation
be? I guess my recommendation is that it's going to ultimately be a hybrid approach, right? That I don't recommend one law. I think one law, I understand the EU Act, and I think the EU Act, first of all, it started before generative AI, right? And then they tried to retrofit that bill so that it includes generative AI. And I think a harms-based approach, a risk-based approach, which is what it, ultimately that law is a good idea. But even the EU, right, then said that they were going to hand off that act to their sectors to define that further, which I think is exactly what I'm in agreement about, that you cannot have risks without context, right? You really need to define risks within a given context, because even the risk levels that are in the act need greater clarity and consistency in a given sector or industry. So I think that is actually almost what Europe is going to wind up doing. And I suspect we will do that here. The question is, what are the common definitions, right, do we need? And it may be around the harms. And then actually, though, in context, I think the different stakes are very different in healthcare and financial services. It's why those two sectors are highly regulated in the United States today versus other sectors. But I, again, the consumer products has regulation in the United States. Transportation has regulation. Agriculture has regulation. And AI is going to be deployed in those sectors. I suspect we will have that incorporated into the regulations in those sectors eventually, as the use is understood in those industries.
No, so that's an excellent point. One of the points that you made, Joanne, obviously is about data equity. You started talking about how the data currently, you know, coming back from a long period of time, and you've done a lot of work in that. Talk a little bit about your work in data equity, and what do you mean when you say data equity, and how does it relate to that for our listeners who don't know what data equity is?
So you're right. Data equity is a concept that hasn't really been fully defined, but it goes to this notion that AI and generative AI may not create even outcomes for everybody. We talk about bias and hallucinations in AI because we talk about how we do not get even outputs or outcomes from every AI activity. And part of that is because of several factors. I talked about how the data that we're using to learn from is not reflective of all members of society. And it's partly just because of how the data has been created up until this time. And so if we want to create models for all parts of society, we need data that reflects those members of society. But we also need to make sure that we're designing algorithmic processes using generative AI or traditional AI that actually are impactful for the communities we are trying to design a solution for, whether that's a financial services product, whether that's a transportation product, a communications product, et cetera. And so I've been working with the World Economic Forum. We've had a council that they've generously sponsored that consists of data experts as well as civil society experts and social scientists to understand what are the impacts on different communities that aren't always reflected in the data. When the data doesn't always reflect a community, and therefore you get unintended outcomes, right? Ones that don't reflect that community, and therefore the conclusions drawn are wrong. So data equity is this idea that a series of actions may be necessary as you are doing a data analysis, as you're creating a new data solution or product. You need to think about what are the outcomes you're trying to achieve for a community or a set of individuals that may not be reflected in the data or may not even have been reflected in how you're thinking about the problem. And what we're doing is we're offering up a toolkit of a series of action steps that organizations can take as they create new products, new solutions, to make sure they're designing for the communities that they're trying to impact. And so it may require creating synthetic data. It may require collecting data that they do not have. It may require thinking about that the data may be slanted naturally just by how it's been created since the beginning of time, that the data may be slanted to the wrong kind of geographic location, population. Maybe it's more male than female and you're creating a female product. Those type of issues need to be part of our product and thinking and product development process early on and be looked at as we look at the output of all these models to adjust the outcomes to make sure that we actually are thinking it through from the beginning to the end of the process. And so that's what data equity means. It really means a series of adjustments to make sure your product is ultimately fit for purpose for the communities in which you're designing for.
This is an important point, Joanne. For our listeners, is there an example that you can give of the harm that could be done if this toolkit, for example, or a framework is not adopted? Just a simple example to bring it to life.
Sure. So one of the members of the council was given a great example. She lives in Africa, and how a there was a water problem in one of the villages. And so an international agency came in and planted more trees because it was a very arid area. And the idea was that more shade would help the soil retain water. And so they planted a whole bunch of trees and went away thinking that this was going to help create more shade, which was going to help the soil retain water. And then they came back about 6 months later and found that all the villagers had chopped down all the trees. And the question from this agency was, well, why did you do that? We thought we were helping the water problem. Well, they didn't do their research appropriately. They had done all the analysis on an adjacent area. And in this location, what the trees actually did was soak up all the water from the roots and actually hurt the village and dried up all the wells. And so this is an example of where, without having the right data for the right community, a conclusion was drawn, an action was taken, and actually harm was done to the location. Now, this is a small example, but it was so vivid when Angela told the story, right? That it stayed with me as a perfect example, small example, right? Of all of us wanting to do the right thing, and yet the action not fitting the community we're designing for. And so if we had the data about that particular village, that solution wouldn't have been deployed, right? It was a solution that had been deployed in lots of other villages and worked, but was the wrong solution for that location. So that's an example, hopefully, that will stick in people's minds.
Oh, that's a great example. Joanne, you briefly touched on a topic that's become a big discussion point, which is synthetic data. What are your views on that? Because some people argue that synthetic data is like making a copy of a copy of a copy, and it gets degraded over time. Because as you know, regulators are working towards it, synthetic data has become an important thing. So tell our listeners a little bit about your views on this.
So I encountered synthetic data first as a privacy officer, right? So synthetic data was first developed as a way to actually solve the privacy dilemma of personal information and as a way to get at characteristics of data without disclosing information about you, Sanjay, or me, Joanne, or any population. And it was actually a solution for a different problem, okay? And which was wonderful, but and it was generated data that would give you a set of characteristics similar to an underlying data set without disclosing anything sensitive or personal about the underlying data set. And I thought it was a wonderful thing for privacy. And I still think it is. I think the challenge now is that synthetic data is also being looked at as a solution for missing data, which it also can help. But the challenge is this: with artificial intelligence and generative artificial intelligence in particular, is that if it is overused, right, the solution can be problematic in the conclusion it draws, because synthetic data is engineered data for certain characteristics. And if it is over amplified in the data set, it will cause outcomes that are not necessarily reflecting the norms of what we will call natural data, data from all of us users that is being pulled in. And it may, if it overrides the natural data, you have to be very careful to see what your output is going to be. I think as engineers, we have to understand when is it appropriate to supplement with synthetic data. The problem is when synthetic data becomes mixed with natural data, and we don't know which is which, and we need to make sure generative AI can tell the difference in our problem sets and solutions. When it goes out into the wild, that's the problem I think everybody's worried about. How will I be able to tell the difference, and how will I be able to validate the conclusions I'm drawing if there's too much synthetic data and not enough natural data in the data set? So I think there's some positive uses for synthetic data. I understand how it can be a very useful tool, but I think there's also ways that it can be overused, and then we will come to the wrong conclusions.
Well, that's very good to know, because that's a big topic of discussion, and regulators are also looking at maybe there are some standards towards that. Joanne, what kind of core ethical principles should be embedded in AI systems in your view?
Oh, so I think, the OECD has done really good work in this area. And this is one where I think, I was part of the group when the OECD came up with their privacy principle, their refresh of privacy principles way back when. That's how long I've been doing data work. And I do think that transparency and explainability are really important. And I know, and I know, I think people think that transparency means we're going to show all the algorithms, which I always, as somebody who works for MasterCard, I used to get the question on, can you show me your fraud algorithm? And it's like, think about that. Just think about it for 5 minutes and understand why that's a bad idea. But I do think transparency of thought and process and governance and reviews and how organizations are strategizing, I do think being transparent and explainable and accountable is really important for it, making sure your partners, your customers, and your employees and your regulators understand what you are doing. And if you can't explain it, well, then what? How do we, does anybody have any confidence in what you're doing? And so I think those principles, those three in particular, are super important. I mean, privacy and security are kind of table stakes at this point. You should be paying attention to those. But the other three, and then having some type of integrity in your process, meaning governance, that somebody ultimately has to be responsible and able to then, I think, with all of the new regulations requiring some level of auditability, you must be able to explain what you're doing and why and what the outcomes are and what your review process is on a regular basis of those outcomes. I think all of those things are just really good basic housekeeping for most organizations. And if you can't do that, if you don't have the talent to do that, then I would urge you to find the talent before you start using these tools, right? I just think it's really important. And at MasterCard, the other piece that we have is we also want to have positive social impact for our products and solutions. We believe that all boats rise in the world if everyone gets to participate. So that's just one of our other principles that I think we'd be in a better place if more organizations thought that way as well.
So those are some important points. You said explainability, transparency, security, obviously being the table stakes. In terms of the reviews and things of that nature, Joanne, does MasterCard have an ethics or an audit board for AI? And what do you suggest that for other organizations?
So we have a governance process. We have an AI governance process. It grew out of our data governance process and our privacy process before that. So we've matured as an organization, as I'm sure most companies have over time as they've become more and more digitally sophisticated. And I would urge every organization to look at their governance practices. What we have found over time is that, in the beginning, our processes were a little bit fragmented. We had a privacy review board and we had a security review board. What we did is we embedded all of it into two things. First, we embed all of these disciplines in our product review cycle. We make sure that our product development process embeds these reviews in it. So that's the first thing. Second, we do have an AI review board that looks at AI-driven products and solutions, and it includes a whole host of disciplines, including the data scientists, but it also includes data quality experts. It includes data designers. It includes, we do A/B testing, of course. But it also includes folks from our technology teams, our privacy teams, our legal teams, our communications teams, and security teams, so that we can make sure that we can explain these products and solutions and our sales teams as well, so that everybody along the way has a point of view on the product or solution. And things have gotten killed just not because we can't do something, but the question is, should we do it and does it align with our brand values? Now, there's different levels of review. We also kind of put our products and solutions on a scale. And so the more risky they are, depending upon the data they're using, what the purpose of the product is, and who it will impact, the higher the requirement for review. All of our reviews are pretty much done, though, by internal MasterCard employees. We do not have an external ethics board or review board as some companies do, although we do talk about it from time to time. I do think that organizations in like healthcare have deployed external review boards very, very effectively, given the issues of like medicine and healthcare and risks related to adverse effects. I do think that in those industries, it makes a lot of sense. I've seen in external review boards and technical companies put to some good use, but I think sometimes it's harder for external experts who don't understand the products and solutions sometimes to fly into an organization. And so at this point, we all of our expertise is in-house.
All of it is in-house. A related point to that, Joanne, is you've been a chief privacy officer. And, you know, obviously now there are chief data officers. With the advent of AI, especially large language models, has that role changed or should it change? This is a feedback that you can provide to CEOs of companies who are listening, who have this kind of a role.
So these roles, you know, in the grand scheme of things, these roles are relatively new in the grand scheme of business, but we've seen, so the IAPP, the International Association of Privacy Professionals, just published an article in the Wall Street Journal. My friend Trevor Hughes, he pinged me just yesterday. So I think it may be in today's paper or yesterday's paper, but about the changing role of the privacy officer and what we've seen that role morph into, and it's not a huge surprise, is being responsible for the laws and regulations around AI, partly because many privacy officers, not all, many privacy officers are lawyers and they have kept up with data regulations and they are well placed to do the thinking behind the trade-offs of how do you apply all of these emerging laws to your operations. And so I do think that that is the change in that job, that if the privacy officer has legal training, and not all do, but if the privacy officer is a lawyer and is in the law department, then having that lawyer also take on those responsibilities with the right team, it makes a lot of sense. Because for quite a long time, the privacy officer has also played a role in data ethics. Now, if you have the ability to also have a chief data officer, and not all companies have both, but maybe they do, or you just have a chief data officers have also played that role if they have been in charge of data governance. Now, many data officers have played a very technical role. Data officers are not all one size fits all. We can have that conversation too. But the mandate of a data officer often does include data governance, data management, data quality. We can talk about the issues around data quality in a minute. As well as data science, as well as data architecture. And those roles, I think, can mature into the AI role if that individual has also done a fair amount of data science and is connected to the strategy of the company, right? It all depends on how that position has been created and what it's been asked to focus on over time. I've also seen some organizations where the privacy officer and the data officer are now reporting into a new position called the chief AI officer. So we're seeing some shifts. I teach at Carnegie Mellon in both their chief data officer and now their new chief AI officer certification program. So we're seeing shifts in all of these positions. But I think the skill sets of these individuals are all super important. The privacy officer, usually from a legal and compliance and risk perspective, the data officer from the data operations, which is the food for AI and the architecture, and then AI, really the science, the data science, the execution, the algorithmic thinking, and also the infrastructure that's needed, connected, all of this connected to the business strategy of what an organization wants to achieve. So that's how I think of the landscape.
Well, that's very helpful. You kind of laid out three different roles, the chief privacy officer, chief data officer, and maybe and now the chief AI officer. You can combine them. That's true.
But I know that many organizations are struggling to find the right skill sets in one person, right? So
absolutely. Joanne, a question that came in from our, a listener was that Is it possible to create unbiased data sets and truly fair AI systems? And what strategies can help mitigate bias in AI systems?
Okay, so today our data is biased. Okay, mm-hmm. I mean, it just is. So the reality is that our data, it depends on who you are and what your organization does, mm-hmm. all right? And I think that, so I'm going to start first with data quality, because I think that mm-hmm. many organizations, mine included, MasterCard, we have processed credit card and debit card transactions, right? Prepaid card transactions for a very long time. The data itself is not biased, okay? It's in how you want to use it and for what purpose you want to use it, right? And so, but our data, right, it reflects where we process and where we do business. And if there, now we have the good fortune of being pretty much truly a global company, right? 210 mm-hmm. markets around the globe. We're a global company. But even for us, not all countries have the same volume of electronic payments as others, right? So some countries are more, still use cash, for example, mm-hmm. or maybe we are have a lesser volume than of our competition, right? Mm-hmm. So even our data, as good as it is and as global as it is, may not be completely even and for payment information around the globe. We know this, and we mm-hmm. will true it up because we recognize that it's flat in some locations. That's what organizations need to do in looking at the data set that they're going to use for the query, the purpose, the problem they're going to solve. It's not that we can fix all the data. We can't. We're not going to get every last piece of data on the planet that we need. But the data scientist, the data quality expert should be able to work together to figure out, okay, what's the problem? What's the purpose we're trying to solve for? Mm-hmm. And then what data do we have? What are the characteristics of this data? What does it tell us? What do we know are its problems? And then together, from a data-driven perspective, figure out, okay, we should know that in these markets, well, cash is king. We need to true up volume of, if it's an economic mm-hmm. exercise, we need to true up the activity for cash payments or on our competition or whatever it is. That's how you remove bias in the answer. We're not going to remove the bias in the data, but we want to remove the bias in the outcome so that we get an equitable outcome for whatever the problem is we're solving. That's how to think about it.
That's great insight. Remove the bias in the outcome because everybody is focused on the bias in the data and how do we cleanse it.
The data is going to get better, and data quality experts, my team, you know, my former team at MasterCard, that we work on this. So the data is going to get better and better the more we're aware. Mm. But also more and more data is going to get created in general, right? So it's really focusing on the purpose and then looking at the data you're going to use. That's how we're going to get to the better answer, right? And mm. that's how bias will get minimized in the algorithmic outcomes. That's what excites me. It's like that kind of thinking. And yes, please don't get me wrong. Data quality is super important, but it's not going to be the only way to do this.
Yeah. Juan, there is a big hue and cry, and I don't know, just briefly, if you can tell our listeners if it's true or not. Everybody is screaming that we are running out of data for these foundation large language models. Are we running out of data? You're a data expert. Tell our listeners, are we running out of data? It's like, are we running out of oil?
So are we running out of data? I don't know that we're running out of data, but there is only so much data that we're generating that's going to be of interest, right? And then we're going to continue to generate data. So the question is, do we have the right data for the purposes for what we're solving for? And at what point does data get stale and that we're waiting for the next wave of information? And I think that's why people are looking at things like synthetic data to supplement that information that we're missing. And I don't know yet, okay? I understand the theory that we're going to not have enough information, but I also think we generate information every day. So there will be a tension between what the models need to consume, but we're also going to be generating new products and new solutions, right? And new information. The question is how much of that will be generated from artificial intelligence and be of good quality, right? Mm. So that we act, remember I said natural data versus synthetic data. Well, then there's artificially generated data. Where that's the tension for me, because I want good quality data, like good food, like a good diet, rather than junk food or synthetic food. Okay. That's the real question. We will not have enough natural data for the appetite of these machines. But what is it that we're trying to solve for? And is artificially generated data going to get in our way? I think that's a question for the foundation model companies to solve. Yes, I do.
Okay, that's great. Joanne, lots more to discuss, but obviously you have, we need to get you back here. Generally, towards the end, we do a quick lightning round of questions that one word answer. It's a little bit of fun, but also gives our listeners a view into how you think, what you think. So, you ready?
Yep, I'm ready.
Okay. Joanne, AI ethics or AI efficiency?
Oh, I'm going to land on the ethics side, but I get the efficiency desire. I sure do.
Okay. Transparency or privacy?
Oh, this is a hard one for me. Transparency.
Okay. You heard it, transparency or privacy. Automation or human oversight?
Human oversight.
Algorithmic bias or data bias?
I can't have both of those.
you can have both. We'll make an exception for you. Okay, we'll go with both. Open source or proprietary?
Oh, man. So I think we have to have open source for the foundation models, but I still think we're going to have proprietary too. For nobody wants your MasterCard charges out on the foundation models, right? So it's a hybrid world we're living in. But
absolutely.
But I do think that to get the kind of innovation that we want, the foundation model companies are going to want to do more open source work. So there's that.
Okay. Global AI standards, achievable or unrealistic?
For harms, achievable, but for specifics, not necessary.
Okay. Final one, biggest AI risk, bias or privacy?
It might be privacy because of the big desire for each one of us to have our own bot. And I think that it's that when that begins to happen, when we all have our own personal agent, I don't know how that's going to intersect with privacy. I'll leave you there with that thought.
Well, that's fantastic. Thank you, Joanne, really for sharing your invaluable insights on AI regulation, data and data governance. You know, your expertise, which spans data privacy and AI, has, you know, provided our listeners with a comprehensive view of the challenges and opportunities in this rapidly evolving field. And as we navigate the complex landscape of AI regulation, you know, voices like yours are crucial in shaping policies that foster innovation while protecting individual rights. So to our listeners, thank you for tuning in to Regulating AI Podcast. Remember, the conversation about fair and responsible AI regulation is ongoing and your engagement is vital. So until next time, keep exploring and contributing to the future of AI governance. Thank you so much, Joanne. This was fabulous. Really, really enjoyed it. And I'm sure our listeners really appreciate your time.
And thank you for having me. This was fun, Sanjay.
Thank you.